I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
If you enjoy listening to the LRB podcast, then you'll probably enjoy reading the LRB. You can subscribe to the LRB from just £1 per issue. To find out more, go to lrb.me/listen. That's lrb.me/listen, or click on the link in the description below this episode.
Hello, and welcome to the London Review of Books podcast. My name is Thomas Jones. It's Tuesday, the 2nd of March, though we're recording this on the morning of Monday the 1st, St. David's Day. I'm speaking with Catherine Moore, a consultant clinical virologist at Public Health Wales, and Rupert Beale, a clinician scientist group leader at the Francis Crick Institute. We're going to be talking about COVID-19, vaccines, variants, and possible ways out of the pandemic. It's almost a year since Rupert Beale wrote his first piece for the LRB on COVID-19. His fifth appears in the current issue. This is his sixth appearance on the podcast. And he was full of praise last spring for the advice his lab had got from Public Health Wales when they were developing testing kits. So it's a great pleasure to have Catherine Moore joining us today as well. Rupert, Catherine, thank you both very much for finding the time to talk to me.
Good morning.
Yeah, morning.
So if we start with the good news, the vaccine rollout in the UK seems to be going astonishingly well. A series of early gambles, informed gambles, no doubt, seem to be paying off. The decision to order the Pfizer and AstraZeneca vaccines in large quantities, the decision to focus on administering first doses and delaying the follow-ups, and that all seems to be working.
I mean, that's right. You know, it's not, as I say, axiomatic that everything we do in this country has to be done badly. Some things in this pandemic we're clearly doing well. The vaccine rollout is, you know, the shining example of that. All sorts of reasons why that's gone well and other things haven't. But I think you've touched on the main points, that the vaccines that we've bought are the ones that have come to market, as it were, the quickest. The ones that have been shown to have efficacy, you know, the fastest, and also critically, the manufacturing capacity has been there to deliver them. And then it's been a question of the NHS and indeed many, many volunteers, you know, quite literally rolling up their sleeves and getting them into people's arms. And yeah, so it's going very well.
And are you vaccinating people yourself? There was a possibility you were going to be, but...
Yes, I've been vaccinating a few people. So the Francis Crick Institute has set up one of these vaccination centres under the auspices of our local hospital. So I've been doing some jabbing and also some consenting of patients coming through. And it's been very good that we've had so many volunteers. I haven't had to do an awful lot of shifts, which I was somewhat dreading in January that I might spend my entire time vaccinating. But, you know, really everyone's sort of pulled together to deliver this.
And is the programme in Wales the same as in England? Is it a UK-wide thing, Catherine, or are you...?
No, we get our own deliveries of the vaccine and we deliver those vaccines ourselves, but pretty much in the same way we have our massed vaccination centres. We're slightly ahead, I think, in terms of who we're vaccinating. Our population's a bit smaller, but so we can get through them a lot quicker. In terms of, you know, who's having the vaccine, we've reached 1 million, I think, over the weekend. So that's that's a third of our population that's already been vaccinated. So it's all going really well. I mean, in terms of me giving vaccines, then I'm too busy here, but we have a nurse practitioner, a specialist nurse practitioner who works with us in virology, and she's currently in the vaccine clinic today giving out her doses of AstraZeneca vaccine.
And other, I mean, the US as well, they're now vaccinating something like 1 million people a day.
Oh, they are phenomenal numbers, yeah.
And the FDA, they're the Federal Drug Administration, they've just given emergency approval to the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, and that's a single dose. And it looks as if the European Medicines Agency are going to approve that in the next few days. And they have 26 million doses ready to go. So presumably Europe should start to catch up. The rest of Europe should start to catch up with the UK once that happens.
Well, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine data is very impressive. Like you say, it's based on a single shot. It's similar sort of technology to the AstraZeneca one. It's an adenoviral vectored vaccine. I suppose that probably the best news from that, and this came out after my piece was published, is that it does seem to be reasonably efficacious against the variant that's circulating in South Africa. So it gives us sort of a reasonable degree of confidence that the current generation of vaccines will have at least some very useful efficacy against the South African variant strain, and probably ones that are similar to it.
And presumably the more different kinds of vaccine there are being used, the harder it is for the virus to develop resistance to all of them. Or is that a very naive view of virus evolution?
It's a very optimistic view. But I don't think it's completely wrong. I mean, generally the vaccines are modelled on the same virus that we first isolated initially from the first cases. But what we're finding is the technologies are so good now that you can change them very quickly. So if we do have a variant that does evade the response, we can manufacture vaccines which match them a lot quicker. So that seems to be one of the really good things which has come out of this pandemic. And I hope really for other infectious diseases as well, that we'll be able to change a lot quicker our vaccine manufacturing from variant to variant, as it were.
Because one of the things which Rupert writes about in his piece is this, what you call it, known as EEC, and I can't now remember what it actually is, E484K or whatever.
That's right, yeah.
Is that right? And that switch that makes it much harder for the vaccine, I'm going to get this wrong, so one of you should explain it, but it means that that problem can be dealt with quite quickly. Is that what you're saying? Maybe if one of you could explain better than I just have what that EEC problem is.
You're exactly right that the variant EEC is E484K, so that's E, the amino acid, which is very negatively charged, very acidic. Position 484 in the original Wuhan strain has swapped to K, which is a very positively charged amino acid in several of the variant strains, including the one circulating in South Africa, one of the ones circulating in Brazil, and some of the ones that have been detected, albeit in rather small numbers, in the UK. And that's one of the places where antibodies are known to bind. And the charge difference means that in the place that previously was negatively charged, where antibodies very often will have evolved a positive charge to bind to it, opposites attract, that those positively charged antibodies in that particular region will be is unable to bind. They'll in fact be repelled by the positive charge, which is now on the variant. And that does seem to be important. So in a variety of different sort of assays that people use, they can show that the level of neutralization of antibodies from people who've been vaccinated or people who have been infected are lower as measured against that variant compared to the Wuhan variant, or indeed some of the other circulating variants, including the B117 Kent variant.
And that's the reason that they've stopped using the AstraZeneca vaccine in South Africa?
Essentially, yes. There was a relatively small amount of trial data from the AstraZeneca trials in South Africa, which in that one instance didn't show a protective effect. What we call the confidence intervals on that were quite wide. In other words, the real number could be anything between, 60% effective or completely ineffective. So it's a bit difficult to tell. But unlike most of the other vaccine trials, that in that particular part of one, it didn't show a protective effect.
I mean, it must be, you know, for people who've perhaps had the AstraZeneca vaccine or any of these, the older, you know, versions, I think what, you know, we need to sort of make clear as a public health message is that actually any vaccination will help reduce severity of disease, even if the response isn't complete to that particular vaccine. What we generally find is that, you know, your risk of severe disease reduces if you are completely protected from the disease in the first place. You know, so I don't think people who've had it should be too worried, you know, in terms of, you know, what's going to happen to them in the future. And those particular variants, certainly in the UK, aren't widespread at the moment.
Yeah, that's good to know. And of course, because there are different ways of measuring efficacy, aren't there? That, whether it prevents any infection, moderate, severe, hospitalization, death, there are all these different ways of measuring how effective they are. That messaging around the AstraZeneca vaccine does seem to have been a problem in Europe, that there seems to be quite a lot of people in France and other countries who are not showing up for their appointments because they don't want the AstraZeneca because they've heard it's not as good. And presumably that's any vaccine is better than no vaccine. And the other thing, of course, about vaccination is that it's not about you as an individual, it's about achieving herd immunity, that sort of phrase, which actually does mean something when it comes to vaccination. Is that right? So the more people are vaccinated with any vaccine that works, the better.
Yeah, so so to attain the herd immunity, you want as many of the population to be immunised, that we know that they've got an antibody response, you know, and we can determine what level of the population is. Because the idea is that what you want to do is to, if should somebody who's not immunised or somebody who's travelled into the country or into a new region who enters a population, you want as many of those not to be susceptible to the virus at all. And that's how herd immunity works. And if this vaccine prevents some of that severe end of infection, you know, albeit in all of those people, it's not preventing infection completely, you're still going to see that knock-on effect, certainly in terms of our hospitals. You're going to see less people coming into hospitals, albeit that they may have a mild infection in the community. But that transmissibility also reduces because there's less susceptible population in that, you know, in that region to allow that virus to spread more widely. I mean, like I say, we, you know, the data that came from South Africa was disappointing in terms of, you know, severe infection. But actually that particular variant isn't widely spread in Europe yet. We still have the so-called Kent variant, which doesn't have that 484K mutation. So the vaccines are very good towards that. And that's true in Europe as well, where we're seeing it taking over some of the other viruses and variants that are circulating there. So, you know, in terms of what we currently have, it's very good. And then what we're seeing as well is the companies are now responding. So certainly Moderna are already developing their next generation assays ready to come into South Africa to actually tackle that 484K. We're monitoring it far more closely so we can see where the spread is, ready to respond should we need to. But it is very unusual for any vaccine to fail completely on the basis of a single change, because bearing in mind that your immune response is multifactorial, it's not just to that particular part of the virus.
Right, that's very good to hear. And also that it doesn't mutate very easily, this virus, does it? That's something which Rupert has made clear in all of his pieces, that it's got...
Yeah, for an RNA virus, I work with some RNA viruses that mutate very readily. This is not a readily mutating virus at all. We might start to drive it a little bit faster as our immune response in the population increases. We get that sort of higher levels of immunity. But, you know, again, I don't expect it to be mutating in the same way as what we would see with some of the other viruses that we have vaccines for. So flu, for example, where we have to change every year, flu has a very different genetic conformation. You know, it's very different in the way it mutates. So I wouldn't expect it to change as quickly as flu, for example.
What's happening with Test and Trace? Is that program going ahead? Is it working any better than it was before? Or... because it's still, vaccination doesn't mean we can give up on Test and Trace, does it? I mean, it's as important as ever. It's got a Test, Trace, Protect as a system in Wales.
Yeah, it is, but it's not run. We run it as part of, so Public Health Wales, the local governments, you know, they run it. We don't have a company in supporting that. It's run by our own sort of population, essentially, you know, so it's our public health, our local governments. They do all of the contact and tracing.
And how can you talk a bit about how that's working? I mean, are they managing to trace most contacts of cases or enough? Or
I mean, we haven't had such a problem in Wales with that particular variant. I mean, that's a very English problem at the moment. Where we have had variants in the past, one of the issues that we are seeing is the turnaround from the result. So bearing in mind that most of these variants are detected using whole genome sequencing, there is an inherent delay in the time from the sample being collected to that result being available. So there is always going to be some retrospective look back that's going to have to be required when these cases are identified. So currently what we're doing at the moment is trying to bring in, first of all, more rapid sequencing for anybody of concern, anybody who's returning traveller, for example, anybody who's been in contact. We're doing far more rapid sequencing in terms of that, so highlighting them first. But then we're also looking at new tests as well, which can detect the variants of concern very quickly, just using our standard PCR testing. So those are all assays now, just all tests just coming into play, which hopefully will help support us when we're trying to find these variants quickly. But like I say, at the moment, the vast majority of that work is being done through whole genome sequencing, which comes with its own inherent delays.
And there's talk in the news today about the so-called Brazilian variant. I know we need to get away from these toponyms, as you say, Rupert, but they're easier to remember than the lists of numbers and letters. The so-called Brazilian variant has arrived in the UK, and it seems that they're having difficulty tracking down one individual in particular.
It's all to do with the contact tracing. So they need to find the person to find out where he's been. I mean, this is all retrospective now, isn't it? I mean, this is, when was he diagnosed? Middle of February?
I can't remember exactly, but they're talking about the first or second week of February when the flight happened.
Yeah, so this is going to be, it's the retrospective look back, because you never know, he may have seeded into an area, or they may have seeded into an area, and you're seeing cases there, but they're not, you know, it might be this variant. And so it's for all of the contact tracing that, you know, that needs to happen around this individual. And I think that comes back to people filling in their own forms as well. You know, sometimes people make mistakes. I mean, if it was coming through our laboratory system, it would be flagged very quickly that the information wasn't complete. You know, so I don't know how, you know, whether it's gone through a Lighthouse lab and they just don't have that same barcoding. But I always presumed the barcoding was pretty clear about who was who.
And is it a much more worrying variant?
It's the 484, which is the key variant at the moment that everybody's worried about. And if it contains 484, then that's what people are really honing in. If it had just been a UK 501Y with no 484, then I think people would be less concerned. Is that right? Is that your feeling about this, Rupert?
Yeah, that's right. I think we have less data on the Brazilian variant than we do on, say, the South African variant. As far as I know, there aren't any trials which have provably shown effectiveness against it. I mean, you would predict that it would be very similar to the South African one, you know, because it shares that 484K and some other mutations, which are quite similar as well. So, yeah, I mean, it is a concern. I'm sure if you were making a film of this, you'd make catching that one person like the most important thing. The film and real life are a bit different. So.
Yeah, and also, and that's such that sort of, I mean, that easy, that individualizing fallacy, which, come, you know, people think, I mean, as with vaccination, the idea that it's a public rather than a private good is quite hard to get your head around.
I mean, I think that testing programs can work extremely well as programs. And that's the way to think about it, and not as a series of sort of one-off tests that people take in a haphazard fashion. And the more people do these tests, the better at doing them they get, the more, you know, institutions, I mean, correct, we've been testing everybody individually since, you know, April to make sure we're not getting outbreaks within the building. And that works extremely well. It's when you sort of go in with a haphazard, you know, let you take these ones, you take those ones, take this one if you want, not that one. then you get into a sort of mess where you can probably end up doing more harm than good with testing.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing that we've had, you know, discussions sort of in the clinical virology world is that we're now doing tests which are screens. They're not the same as, we're not diagnostically trying to find cases with symptoms and all the things that we're looking around. Asymptomatic screening, you know, in with our screening hats on, we have a whole set of algorithms. So if you find a positive, you confirm that positive using other tests, and that's not happening, which is something which I think a lot of my screening colleagues are finding quite difficult to get their heads around, particularly as we go into a low prevalent population. So as the epidemic reduces, because your risk of false positives goes up, and that's really hard to tell the public, what the heck does that mean, you know? But normally in you know, like if you were going for your cervical screening or your, you know, breast testing, you, if you find an abnormality, you don't immediately say you've got cancer. You do a whole list of tests to confirm that result. And that hasn't been happening. And yeah, so when we've had screening people in our meetings, when we've been talking about testing strategies, that's the one thing that, you know, they've really struggled with, you know, that we don't have that, you know, belts and braces approach that we would normally have around screening programs.
When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment your work stress disappears as you kayak through the canyons. Or the moment you discover the life-changing effects of prickly pear chocolate. But nothing beats the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the very first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at hereyouareaz.com.
Once it is more under control and vaccination is more widespread, would you need to have a screening program for COVID or not really? Because it's not the kind of thing that, if you have a decent vaccination program, you don't need a screening program.
I mean, it depends. Well, it depends what level you've got it down to. I mean, if it's down to a sort of fairly low level, but you're still at risk of outbreaks with, you know, pockets of unvaccinated people, obviously you need to keep that up. And my guess is we'll probably need to have, Catherine, you may be able to talk more about this, we'll probably need to have restrictions on travel for some while, or at the very least testing under those circumstances, just in case we do get, you know, potential variants of concern arising elsewhere. But yes, once the great bulk of the population is vaccinated, the prediction would be that transmission will go down very low. And, you know, this huge effort that we're having to put in correctly and to put into testing and isolation and so on will drop off, and we'll be in a much more normal situation.
We move into what we call enhanced surveillance mode, which we do all the time for flu. So we have a network of laboratories around the world which monitor flu circulation and emerging flu types, such as H5N8. And what we look at is changing the virus over time, but in a surveillance network. And I suspect that as we move into that and the vaccine, you know, uptake is good, and we know that, you know, we've got a bit more information about how long it's likely to last and whether we need to keep monitoring, the surveillance networks will fit in, you know, and start acting as they should at the moment. It's very difficult to do surveillance at the moment when you're testing everybody, because you don't know what your population is that you're measuring. But once we're able to do that, I think you'll see those kick into action really well. And we're certainly starting to look at it for the vaccine efficiency, you know, the effectiveness. So we're already starting to do some surveillance around people who have been immunised, and should they acquire an infection or become infected after their immunisation, we can look at those viruses in a bit more detail.
And that surveillance for flu also enables you to develop the vaccine, sort of predict them. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah, it informs about changes, certainly in the antigenic recognition, so bits our immune response recognizes, we can monitor those more effectively. But like I said, it's still a very new virus. We don't know, you know, the 484s come as a bit of a blow for people, because we, you know, is it going to accumulate around that if we let it keep going, you know, and if it does, what does that mean for the vaccines that we have? So it's important to keep transmission low in the population to prevent that likelihood occurring, that likelihood of variants emerging.
And that means continuing to wear masks and and that kind of thing as well for a while? Or is that hard to say?
Well, I mean, yes, we still have a lot of virus. I mean, the R number is below one, and that's good, and it's going to carry on coming down, I imagine, for some while. But there's still quite a lot of virus out there. So if we, you know, relax the restrictions at the moment, we would be in a situation where you've got a high amount of, as it were, selective pressure on the virus to evolve to escape immunity, and also a high amount of virus circulating, which is the highest chance, if you like, of generating variants that resist immunity. So that's why it's really important to keep suppressing the virus at the moment. You can also see it. I mean, if we were in a situation where we hadn't got any restrictions and we had people coming into the country, let's say with the Brazilian variant, then, you know, the difficult job that's being undertaken at the moment with tracing those individuals would become virtually impossible, because it wouldn't just be the case that you're, you know, trying to work out if they seeded somewhere. They would have seeded everywhere. You know, they'd have come into contact with loads of people, and we'd have this variant spreading, you know, probably reasonably rapidly, assuming that it does at least partially escape immunity. So that's the situation we're in, and why it's important to be extremely cautious as regards relaxing restrictions.
Cautious optimism.
We can be optimistic if we can be cautious. That's how I put it.
Optimistic caution, not cautious optimism. Optimistic,
yes.
Yeah. And looking ahead, without putting any dates on it, to when we finally emerge from the pandemic, in your piece, Rupert, you described two possible ways out. Either SARS-CoV-2 becomes another endemic coronavirus, giving rise to large numbers of infections in winter, or possibly every other winter, or we manage, and the comparison you make is with measles, to eliminate it. And that's obviously the more desirable outcome. But what does elimination mean? And how achievable is it? How would you set about?
Well, people immediately say that, you know, measles is a very different virus to coronaviruses, and they'd be absolutely right. And the vaccine we have for measles has been extremely effective, and it hasn't really needed updating since, I think, the 60s. So Catherine, you may correct me if I'm wrong, but I mean, it really has been going a very long time. And it's not because the virus itself is inherently a very stable one. It mutates rather more quickly, in fact, than intrinsically rather more quickly than coronaviruses. It's because the target of that vaccine is something that's very difficult for the virus to change, if you see what I mean. So that's sort of why it's such an effective vaccine. So it's really not so much about the virus in this case. It's really about the effectiveness of the vaccine. So the reason I give the two scenarios is as follows. So we know that natural immunity to the circulating seasonal coronaviruses that we have is not sufficient to prevent reinfection. And there are probably two main reasons for that. One is that immunity wanes over time. So, you know, if you got infected with one of the seasonal coronaviruses 5 years ago, the amount of immunity you'll have will be less than if you were infected with one last year. And the other is that there is, you know, evolution taking place with these viruses, and they undergo something we call antigenic drift, which means that slowly over time, the match for the immunity that you had to one of these seasonal strains sort of declines. In other words, that the virus has evolved mutations that allow it to partially escape immune responses. So if the vaccines that we have are really only going to be as good as naturally occurring immunity, the expectation would be, a guess, because, you know, we're predicting into the future, that you would end up with SARS-CoV-2 ending up very much like one of these seasonal coronaviruses, that because people have been infected in the past, they have some partial degree of immunity to it, so they're less likely to get severe disease, but still over time they might become reinfected. The reason I bring up the comparison with measles is because, like Catherine was mentioning, the vaccines we have to these viruses, these new kinds of vaccines, the RNA vaccines, the adenoviral vector vaccines, they're not just incredibly effective, but they may also be ones that we can update more rapidly over time, so that we can not just perhaps catch up with the virus, but, if you like, get ahead of the virus, predict what circulating variants are going to be, match the vaccine very quickly to them, and get to a point where so many people in the population have had a vaccination which is likely to protect them not just against the variants at the moment, but the future variants, that we might be able to really completely eliminate it from the population. Now, by eliminate, I don't mean get rid of to zero everywhere in the world. I mean get down to very, very low levels within a defined population. In this case, it could be the population of the UK. Again, a comparator. Catherine will have seen many cases of measles during the course of her career. I've only ever seen one case, you know, as a medical doctor. So it's really now very, very rare. And of course, it used to be an incredibly common childhood infection. So that's what I'm talking about when I say get to elimination, and why measles is to some extent a sort of a reasonable comparator if we can get the vaccines that really work against all the future strains.
And do you share that assessment, Catherine?
Yeah, I think it is feasible if we can get enough of the population immunised. I mean, we don't actually know yet what that herd immunity level is actually required yet for this particular virus. That's normally calculated once we know what the vaccine effectiveness is and the R number of the virus, should it be in a susceptible population. You can work out then from that the number of people needed to be immunised to eliminate a virus. So, for example, measles, which is one of our most infectious viruses, is probably currently the most infectious virus known to man, you have to have a vaccine. So that's two doses of vaccine up in the high 90s to prevent transmission in the population. Now, it's very likely that the R number for this virus is nowhere near measles. Measles is, you know, 14 to 20. You know, it's a huge, huge number compared to what we've got now. So you may find that actually, if we get to levels of maybe 60 to 70% of the population, that would be enough to help prevent some of that transmission going on in the community. My real concern is vaccine inequalities and inequities that we're seeing in the population at the moment. So we're seeing little cohorts of certainly BAME people are not getting their immunizations for whatever reason. Now, whether that's because they're not able to access some of the mass testing centers, vaccination centers, isn't clear. But then also we have countries in the world, you know, which don't have the same health systems that we do in the West, who have zero uptake at the moment. There is no vaccination going on in some countries. And that to me is a real concern, because like measles, what you always have is a risk then of reintroduction into a population, because bearing in mind, we have to maintain these vaccines year on year to keep that elimination status. And certainly what we saw with measles is as soon as you have the MMR levels drop below sort of 80%, you have this, you can have these huge outbreaks occurring because there's no immunisation. So it's not just now where we're all motivated to get our immunisation, it's going forwards as well. And whilst this virus exists in the world, there's always a risk that, you know, we can reintroduce it into areas that perhaps have taken their eyes off the ball in terms of getting their, keeping their immunisation rates up.
Yeah, and last week there was talk about the first 600,000 doses of AstraZeneca vaccine made in India arrived in Ghana. And that's great that that's happening, but it's still very small numbers, isn't it? I mean, it needs to be, you know, the global push needs to be a lot stronger than it is now.
I mean, there was some lovely sort of comments made on social media, you know, because we know that the risk of this infection for, you know, in terms of your own personal risk increases in with the age range, you know, so as you get older, you're more likely to get severe illness. And I know people are quite willing, you know, to carry on maintaining the mitigation if that vaccine that is destined for them, being a healthy young person, perhaps would be, you know, spread a bit more evenly globally. We've bought a lot for us and seem to have forgotten that there are countries that are not going to have the same access, you know, and they are being, you know, dramatically affected by this virus as well.
I suppose there's also the question of, it's a bit early to be talking about this, but also the next pandemic virus that comes along, that what have we... But presumably up to point, what we've learned, well, what you have learned from studying SARS-CoV-2 this year, the massive amount of scientific research that's been done on this virus and on tests for it, on the incredibly rapid vaccine development, that a year ago it wasn't clear it was possible to create vaccines against coronaviruses, and now we have half a dozen. So how many of the things that you've learned and the technologies that have been developed will you be able to take forward against other viruses? I just partly a tweet of yours that I saw last week, Catherine, that you're talking about looking forward to being able to use some of the tools you have for other viruses?
Yeah, not just the tools. I mean, it'd be lovely if we can. I mean, there are, you know, children every year affected by enteroviruses, for example, and, you know, and RSV is another virus which is currently, vaccines are being produced for that virus.
So RSV stands for?
Respiratory syncytial virus. It's an infection that very young babies get. It causes bronchiolitis, and we see peaks of it every winter with high levels of children brought into hospitals. And in some countries, you know, obviously where you have children who are very vulnerable, it is a significant cause of pneumonia and mortality in other countries as well. But there are vaccines on the horizon for those. And you know, it just makes me quite sad that actually we hadn't put that much effort into a virus that, you know, has been circulating for such a long time with some of these newer technologies, and yet suddenly a new virus comes along and we've responded so quickly. But yeah, I think if we can take it forward and adapt it, but also the certainly the networking that we're getting from this as well. I mean, you know, never before have a lot of services come together to try and to support a response. So testing, academic centres setting up their testing, you know, the hospitals working with screening services. It's been quite remarkable how we've kind of developed a, you know, really good network of virologists, epidemiologists, you know, not just the armchair ones, but, you know, like, you know, people who do it as a day job. You know, we are actually talking together like we've never done before. I'd like to see that going forward, because it's all of this together which will help us fight the next pandemic.
Catherine Moore, Rupert Beale, thank you both very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
You can read Rupert Beale's piece in the latest issue of the LRB, along with Terry Castle on Patricia Highsmith, Rosemary Hill on London's West End, and Colm Tabin on Francis Bacon.
Thanks for listening. You can find a link to LRB pieces relevant to this episode in the description below.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.